This is Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century History Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century History Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, your 20th Century History Guy. We're talking today about the American news media. With all the anxiety in the air about where the media may be headed in the future, we thought we'd devote an hour to looking at where it's been in the past.
We're going to take another call now from Minneapolis, Minnesota. We've got Marin on the line.
Hi there.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. On the issue of objectivity and partisanship, I wanted to suggest something for you folks to think about. And it's kind of a recent example, but it's in the history of our country. And that's how the newspaper of New Orleans has dealt with the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
All of us, of course, in journalism want very much, or we were trained to be objective and to be very nonpartisan. And in the complete wreck of the city after Katrina, the New Orleans Times-Picayune pretty much said to itself and to its readership, you know, we're kind of done with that. We are going to take a point of view about our city, which is that this city was neglected during Katrina, and say, you know, we just say, even in our news pages, it's really important for us to get more police. It's really important that XYZ corruption isn't going to happen anymore. We're not going to attempt to give as much weight as we would have formerly to the other side of this question. It seems to me they're really going back to a kind of 19th century model of journalism where everyone was very unafraid to say...
Well, I think you said the magic word, Marin, 19th century. You're really asking about this association between newspapers and the city that they represent, and does that sometimes break down this model of objectivity? I'd love to hear from Peter and Ed on that.
Yeah, I think, Brian, what you're describing is exactly the way it was in the 19th century. You had this paradox of every small town having multiple papers filled with outrage against the people at the other paper, the Democrats versus Republicans by and large. And they vied to proclaim themselves the real voice and protector of the real community. So you had this strange thing of partisanship and kind of loyalty to the locale egging each other on. And so the reason that the Times-Picayune thing now sticks out so much is that you don't really have a vital partisan press that's fueling rivalry to see who can be the best advocate for the locale.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point, Ed.
I would agree with you, and I'd say that, you know, you guys know that, of course, the parties themselves were the quintessential advocates of local benefits. That's how they maintained themselves. They got jobs for the area. They got key transportation routes going through their areas. They got government subsidies for the areas. As the role of political parties declined in the early 20th century with the rise of civil service and all that, newspapers became the key advocates for the city. And their advertising came from the key businesses within those cities. So often, you know, newspapers took the attitude that, you know, what was good for Asheville was good for the newspaper. What was good for New York was, or Philadelphia was good for the newspaper as well. So there's, you know, Marin, you've touched a historical nerve here. Have we touched any of your nerves?
What I think is so interesting about this is that all over the country, newspapers are coming apart at the seams. People aren't reading them anymore. People have other things to do with their time. But the relationship of the Times-Picayune to New Orleans, ever since they took this point of view that they weren't really going to bother being objective anymore with regard to partisanship on behalf of New Orleans, their audience can't get enough of them. And if anyone had attempted the kind of lack of objectivity in a positive way that they are now attempting in their news pages, without that to frame it, I don't think it would have been successful. It would have looked like that 19th century debased my city, my party above all, that we look back on with not so much fondness. It's because what happened to the city was so out of scale that the newspaper's reaction seems in scale to it.
Well, I think one of the things we're saying, Marin, is that maybe the caricature of the 19th century is exaggerated, and there are some things about that notion of a shared community that are important to recapture.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if the worldwide financial implosion isn't a Katrina for our times, and that you won't get a lot of hard reporting, critical of both what governments are doing and what the banks are doing, of course, and that might, again, be a framework for a new kind of civic engagement.
I think if you look at some of the stories in the Times about the Wall Street bonuses that were paid out of the bailout money, you start to see that. Even in the Midwestern edition, on the front page of the business section of the Times, they ran a column right next to the news story. And if you look from one to the other, the sort of degree of outrage expressed in the language choices is almost identical. In both cases, it's just what were they thinking and how can they think this is okay? So I think you're right.
Well, it's interesting how the outrage for the financial collapse has to be personalized before we can really get upset about it. You know, because otherwise it's like, oh boy, I'm really furious at these market forces.
Yeah, right.
Well, as long as those market forces fly in corporate jets, people are going to be pretty upset. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. So there's hope for the future. As long as the future looks bleak, we have hope. Maren, thanks for that upbeat call.
Thank you, Maren.
Nice to talk to you. Thanks.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Moving right along, we've got another call from right here in our hometown of Charlottesville, Virginia. It's Elliot. Elliot, welcome to Backstory.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Hey. Well, we're doing pretty well. We're talking about the press, and you got something to bring to the table.
Yeah, I was thinking about our partisan journalism of the past and also what a lot of our media has evolved into today. You know, we have this notion of a golden age of journalism, starting with the 50s and going up right into the 60s with broadcasters like, you know, Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite. But was this an anomaly in our history?
Yes.
Right. So Brian, what explains the exception? Why this anomaly? Why in this one period do values which many of us now hold central to our understanding of, you know, how the civil discourse should be reasonable and all this, it turns out not to be the American way.
Yeah, I think it's pretty simple. It is two factors. The Cold War was one, and there was a remarkable consensus, culturally speaking and politically speaking, on the question of the threat from the Soviet Union externally, less consensus, obviously, on internal subversion, but certainly some broad agreement on concern about that. So you had a society that saw eye to eye on a number of major issues, which happened to deal directly with who we are as Americans. That's one factor. Number two, technology, the rise of television. And the fact that you only had three choices in terms of networks. And so structurally, to get a healthy market share, those networks had to tend towards the middle. In fact, they had to behave very much like American political parties often would prefer to behave, and that's to tend towards the middle and get that viewer in the middle.
You know, it's very interesting to think, though, that, Brian, that the institutional embodiment of that outran the content of it, by which I mean, it strikes me that the civil rights movement and Vietnam sort of shattered the illusion of objective truth.
Absolutely.
And the television cameras had to figure out, yikes, which side of this civil rights struggle do we represent, which side of this war? Mm-hmm. But we still just had three networks throughout the 70s. And it's like you could just sort of watch the disjunction between the mechanism by which a fractured reality can be conveyed and the reality itself. So you watch the Smothers Brothers or Laugh-In, which starts making fun of the you know, the homogeneity of the machinery.
That's a great point.
Does that seem true to you?
Yeah, well, you know, now I have 60 ways to get mad. It's not just the New York Times.
You do. But I think what Brian is suggesting is that when we're nostalgic for a golden age of journalism when there were shared canons of objectivity and so forth, we're really nostalgic for the whole thing, for everything that went with that. And it behooves us to understand that there are good things and bad things about
it. And it behooves us to remember who was left out of that.
Exactly right.
Virtually all African Americans, just to start with. Women as independent, minded, political, and social contributors. What I described was not describing this to suggest a golden age. Peter Brearley put his finger on it. There was a certain shared consensus, a belief in objectivity, but that was achieved at some terribly high costs. And it turned out to paper over a lot of information that citizens in a democracy should have known in order to have a vigorous debate about their government's policies.
Well, thanks a lot, guys. Great
thank you, Elliot.
To you.
Great talking
thanks
with you.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Well, guys, we've covered a lot of ground today, from the rise of the partisan press way back in Peter's period to the penny papers and then the wire services in Ed's period, up through the progressive era and the Cold War and the sense of consensus that emerged in the middle of the 20th century. In some ways, the story of the first half of the 20th century is one of homogenization, the consolidation of news media. But as we know, the internet really blew that wide open, which leaves us where we started the show, with the prospect of a gazillion little media outlets, each catering to a niche audience. Recently, I had the chance to speak with one of the rare journalists of my age who's not freaked out about this new state of affairs. Michael Kinsley, who over the course of his long career has been the editor of The New Republic, a panelist on CNN's Crossfire, and founding editor of Slate.com, one of the first generation of internet magazines. I asked Michael whether the new media landscape wasn't leading people to basically look for reflections of themselves, their own identities, their political views, in the news they choose to consume.
Well, I think that's probably true. I'm not sure what harm it does. And I do think that, you know, you can't forget how easy it is to click away on the web.
Yeah.
And when people are reading, even if their intention is only to read about subjects they're interested in or only to read the political take they're interested in, chance, I know this is true of me, if I'm going to spend a half an hour or an hour reading the news, I start with the New York Times, but I can never get through with the New York Times because I end up clicking away to something else that attracts me.
Right.
And I would suspect if you could do a study, you would find that even the most narrow-minded person is being exposed to a wider range of views now than they were before the web started.
Michael, could I ask you about your own personal experiences with objectivity over the course of your career?
Well, my relationship to objectivity is I've never had a job that required it. From the beginning, I've always worked for either little opinion magazines or big magazines where you were permitted to have an opinion, or, you know, television. And I think that opinion journalism can be more accurate in a way and more informative than so-called objective journalism. You know, you've got very complicated subjects, especially these days, you know, the TARP, bailing out the banks, the Federal Reserve, the Treasury. I mean, these are issues that are very difficult.
Right.
And if you have to have constantly in the back of your mind that you can't ever reach a conclusion for fear that you're violating the canons of objectivity, I think that can limit a writer.
Now, let me ask you, how are we going to ensure as a polity that just what you were talking about, well-informed, some might even call it investigative, factually-based reporting that does come to a conclusion in order to get closer to a higher truth, how are we going to ensure that that happens? Who's going to pay for that? Where are we going to find that?
Well, there's a new model emerging just in the past few months, which is various nonprofits are setting themselves up and foundations are backing projects for reporting.
Right.
And very senior reporters, basically, who are no longer being hired by newspapers, are hired by these places. And there's one or two that are setting up foreign bureaus, even as newspapers close them. And I suppose that is the best hope at the moment. You know, that could evolve into a system where nonprofit foundations fund a lot of the long-term, serious reporting, and newspapers sort of get it for free and thereby are able to keep publishing. It's not especially appealing to me but it is the only promising model at the moment for the future of newspapers.
So you do think ultimately it's promising, and your concerns really are practical ones of it being sustained?
Well, it's certainly to someone who grew up with the traditional newspaper as a private corporation that, and as recently as 5 years ago, was making outrageous sums of money from monopolies in major cities. To go from that to being essentially wards of charities is certainly a brutal come down. But, you know, life changes, life goes on. I assume that's one of the lessons of history. And beggars can't be choosers.
Michael Kinsley is a columnist for Time magazine and the founder of Slate.
Let me tell you how stupid I was when I started Slate. I thought what would happen would be once a week, people would turn on their computers, go to this site called Slate, hit a button, and print out something that looked like a magazine. And then if they had a stapler, they'd staple it all together and spend the week reading it. This was 1995, mm-hmm. It's not as bad.
We were all stupid in 1995.
Yes, right.
You know, listening to all of this, you have to be struck by there's really not much new under the sun, well, or the moon, as the case would be, that we struggle with the same challenges of markets, of the news that people need, of who has the right to tell the news. And no matter how the technology changes, we keep struggling with the same things over and over again, which is both reassuring and a little alarming.
Well, Ed, it's certainly true that we keep going around in circles, but I would say there has been one straight line, and that's from a news-starved public in my period to a news-saturated public today.
Yeah, that's certainly true. People now came and seem to absorb all the news that comes our way. That's what it feels like to us, and it's like, oh my gosh, it's not just I haven't read today's paper. It's that there's just a constant flood of this stuff.
Well, give it a few years, folks. Let it all settle down, and then tune us in. We'll explain it to you.
Yeah, we'll still be sitting here.
When it's history.
Well, that's all the time we have on our show today. But we'd love to keep the conversation going. Visit us online and leave us a comment with your thoughts about today's show. We'll do our best to respond.
Our URL is backstoryradio.org. You can sign up for our podcast and our newsletter there. And you can listen to a special bonus feature produced by our own Rachel Quimby, who tells us about the little fellow who some people say put the yellow into yellow journalism.
And if you'd prefer to leave us a message the old-fashioned way, go right ahead. Our phone number is 888-257-8851. Thanks for listening.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Rachel Quimby, and Catherine Moore, with help from Lydia Wilson. Jamal Milner mastered the show, and Gabi Alter wrote our theme. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major production support for Backstory is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Perry Foundation Incorporated, Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation, UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs, and an anonymous donor.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond.